Today's program is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Kat Johnson kicked the season off with an episode about food and football, so now we're turning to one of my favorite sports, talking about cookbooks. We'll take a sneak peek at a few recipe breakthroughs that Rose Levy Barenbaum discovered while working on her 12th cookbook.
You know, so this was such a eureka thing. People ask me if I still keep learning, and yeah, just thinking about it and trying to find a better way. It happens.
And hear about the challenges of writing a book about alcohol from HRN host Souther Teague.
The history of drinking is very blurry because people were drinking and no one was taking notes.
Plus, we'll get all the expert dish about the most exciting cookbook titles heading to bookstores this fall.
Like jazz music, it's been a part of American cuisine for centuries.
Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to know when the next episode drops.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Guys, it's sometime in September 2018, and I'm Jimmy Carboni, host of Beer Sessions Radio. We've been off for a few months. I was in the hospital, and we're back today, so I don't even know what day it is. But look who we got in this room, man. We're trying to kick off the fall season with some of our favorite people from the New York City craft independent beer scene. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves?
I'm Justin Phillips from Beer Table.
Noah Evan, also from Beer Table.
I'm sorry, I thought we were going in like order, and then I realized it's so I've already screwed up your show, Jimmy. Welcome back. I'm John Hall from various things that I do with words and beer.
But you're the author of?
Of the new book that's out called Drink Beer, Think Beer, Getting to the Bottom of Every Pint, available where fine books are sold.
Well, it's great to have you guys on the show, and I really appreciate it. This show means a lot to me. Heritage Radio Network is such a very special on-air. It's a podcast. It's been a radio network. We're going into our 10th year. Next year, there's going to be a lot of celebrations, and I'm really proud that this is the 9th year of Beer Sessions Radio. We've done over 440 episodes, but guys like John and Justin, you guys have been on quite a few shows over the year, so it's good to be back. I know some listeners here, heard about me. I had some crazy spine infection disease, and I was just got out of the hospital today. So of course, the first thing I'm doing is coming out to Roberta's Pizza in Brooklyn, and our new engineer here, Matt Patterson's here. We got Katie Mosman and Kat Johnson from the radio network here with us. So
Kennedy couldn't be bothered to show up. Your producer extraordinaire couldn't be bothered to show
and
up.
And Justin Kennedy, a lot of new things. There's Dylan. We've got a new intern, and Justin Kennedy's his kids starting some. Pre-K, and he has to pick her up. So a lot of changes, a lot of new things. But, the world beer, it's very different, you know. And first seeing what you guys have done, Justin, I know Beer Table, you were this really awesome little boutique craft beer bar restaurant. And now you guys are like specialty retailers in Grand Central, you know. And John, you know, I've known you as a writer, but I think you really sum it up in your book, Think Beer, Drink Beer. You really covered all the bases. And I think let's just start talking about that. You know, big question is, you know, how do we define the beer that we're drinking? You know, it's what are we drinking? Is it in your book? You say there's craft, there's small batch, but it seems like everyone's pushing the independent label from the Brewers Association, and you talk about that in your book. So where are we at? What are we drinking? How do we define these beers that we like?
I guess the biggest thing is I don't know if we need to define these beers. You know, if it's a beverage that's made with water and malt and hops and yeast, and it's done in a brewing process that creates beer at the end of the day, be it a Saison, be it a Pale Ale, be it a New England IPA or a pastry stout or whatever else is out there these days, anytime that we start putting words before the word beer, things get muddy. So in the beginning, it was microbrew, and then when the industry kind of broke down a little bit, and we had this sort of bubble burst, as it were, in the late 90s, early 2000s, the word microbrew became dirty, so they needed to rebrand, and so it became craft. And craft beer was supposed to be this awesome thing, and it is in a lot of ways, but it is such a tough thing to define. You know, is it ownership? Is it spirit? Is it technicality? Is it who knows what? And so, you know, now the larger players, Anheuser-Busch and Miller and all of them, have started buying what were formerly craft brewers, Goose Island, Blue Point, et cetera. And so that word has gotten muddy. And now the Brewers Association, thanks so much, the Brewers Association is pushing independent as the next thing. So drink independent beer. The problem that I have with this is I don't know what independent tastes like. You know, and the problem is there are so many small breweries that are out there these days who are passionate people who are making beer. But
it's like the 4th of July beer.
Pretty much. Well, yeah. But like, okay, so it's fireworks and explosions and eating too many hot dogs down at Nathan's. Like, okay, like, I don't know if I necessarily want that in January. But, the thing is, and I can sum it up this way. I was at this brewery in Washington State, and really nice people, really passionate people who had opened up their brewery. And I stopped in, and I said, I only have a few minutes before I go. What's your flagship? And they said, oh, we make an alt. And I was like, that's awesome that you guys have an alt as your flagship. And as they're pouring the pint, I'm looking up behind the bar, and they have all of their T-shirts, all of their merchandise, and they have this upside-down bottle logo, this Brewers Association, National Ketchup Association logo that they have going these days to certify independence, right on the sleeve of the T-shirt. And I say, wow, that's really cool. I haven't seen that on clothing before. And they said, well, we believe that we should wear our independence on our sleeve. I was like, that's cool. And then they put a glass of Diastol down in front of me. How can you support independence when the beer is clearly flawed? And so, you know, I'd rather drink 1,000 Budweisers before I'd rather drink a full pint of Diacetyl. And so when we start putting some of these words in front of beer these days, it sort of muddies who it is. I like knowing where my dollars go. I like supporting small local businesses if I'm getting a good product in return. And independence doesn't guarantee that I'm getting quality beer in return. So in the book, I advocate saying, if we're going to call it anything, let's just call it beer, let the chips fall as they may, and then start to figure it out from there.
So let's back up. So Noah, at Grand Central, I mean, you guys have a very busy beer store there. You're doing, I'm almost going to call them specialty beers. I mean, how would you describe to your customers what you're selling?
I try and tell them we focus on smaller breweries. We try and support as many independent breweries as we can. But yeah, the focus is on small and independent. Can't always do that. And obviously things have gotten pretty convoluted in the last few years with acquisitions and private equity getting involved, but, you know.
I'm curious, because you guys have a great shop, and you guys get to taste everything that comes in. It's a smaller shop, so you probably have to have difficult conversations with breweries sometimes and being like, hey, we really want to support you because you're a small guy, but we can't sell this.
Yeah, that absolutely happens. You have to tell people, just don't see it up on our shelves. We really didn't do it for us, and it's a bummer when it's people you know and like, but I guess so. I agree with what you're saying, that foremost our dedication is to quality, and then
yeah, because I mean
we have other stipulations on top of that.
Because the other part of it too is as a journalist and other folks, if you gave somebody knowingly sold them a pint that was filled with diacetyl or you know oxidized or whatever it was, it'd be a poor reflection on you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know when our credibility goes in terms of being able to provide people with good beer, then what do we have?
Yeah. Ooh, I like that sound.
I think you said that really well, John.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. So for me, Beer Table, I mean, like the vision from the very beginning was to not care about style categories or to care about anything other than flavor and deliciousness. And to organize, you know, our menu and our shelves in the store is all organized by flavor. It's always been that way. And that's all we care about really is like, is it going to taste good and be a good experience? And
yeah. What are some of the flavors that you categorize?
For us, we do it as a progression. So we do it as like, from before a meal all the way through a nightcap. You know, that's how I think of the entire shelf left to right. And that's how the menu was at the old place.
That's really cool. Because you can have all sorts of styles before a meal. I mean, you can start a meal with absolutely. Like a, you know, with a brown ale or, you know, with a Saison.
And it doesn't
something.
Have to be low alcohol to be early. You know, it can be, you know, anything.
Yeah.
So it gives us a lot of freedom and it lets people who know nothing about beer really enjoy the shopping experience and kind of be able to help themselves, even though we're there to talk to them about whatever they want to know. And these guys do a great job with lots of info.
So you're not defining it. No, it's just like, it's like, well, over here's some after happy hour, before dinner, then here's dinner, dessert course,
exactly.
Yeah. Nightcap.
I mean, and we definitely get the guys in who we describe that to, and they immediately go straight to the farthest right corner where our post-dinner drinks would be, and like, oh, this is me.
But, so it's like the guys at the festival, like, give me your strongest.
Exactly, yeah.
In the back, yeah. Sir.
I've got a 20-minute train ride.
Do you guys hide those behind the beaded curtain, like at the old video stores, like that kind of thing?
John, you've had quite a life, man. From your book, I know more about you than I ever knew. So you started as a journalist. So yeah. You're a journalist.
Yeah.
And you started as a journalist. And how did you start writing about beer?
Accidentally.
Because now people think that's like the dream job.
Yeah. And until the morning, like the next morning, like everybody thinks it's a great job. But then, you know, those late nights are kind of murder. I fell into it accidentally. As a reporter, you're sort of trained to follow your curiosity. And as a reporter, and I used to cover crime and politics and environmental issues and pretty much anything under the sun, I was a general assignment reporter. And in my free time, I discovered good beer and I started drinking about good beer. So it was this sort of natural progression of one day being like, hey, I should write about this. And I had some editors that were really cool and encouraging and let me do it. And then after I left daily newspapers, folks like Tony Forder at Ale Street News and Tom Daldorf out at Celebrator gave me a start in the beginning, and then I was able to go and work at All About Beer as the editor for a couple of years and write some books along the way, and now I'm at Craft Beer and Brewing, and it's been a weird decade and a half of writing about beer. I never thought that this would be my full-time profession, but man, I can't imagine doing anything else. I get to be front and center for some of the coolest things happening in beer right now and talk with really smart people who know a lot of really cool things about beer. And then I get to communicate that to people who are really enthusiastic. So what I do is a real privilege.
That's great, man. Thanks for coming on. So Justin, talking about what are we drinking? What are we drinking?
This is my first time to have it. I'm going to have Noah talk about it.
This is my first time as well. But this is Extra Extra from Stillwater, one of our favorite breweries.
Yeah, I really dig it.
And this is a double IPA in the style of a brewed IPA.
Is that what they're going with it?
Okay. A new thing that's come on the scene somewhat recently, definitely in the last 6 months, I would say, we started hearing about it. Started November. Out in San Francisco, Social Kitchen and Brewery.
And it's called a brewed IPA.
Brute.
Oh,
yeah,
brute.
You know, like dry. Champagne. Yeah. And what they are doing is adding an enzyme that breaks down sugars and malts, so they're very easily fermentable. It's something that's used in beer generally, in bigger beers, like big IPAs, big stouts, to kind of lighten the body a little bit and make the fermentation a little bit easier. But they're adding it to these usually sub 7% beers to really let the yeast get at the sugars, trying to get it down to, you know, to 0 degrees Plato, and making like a super crisp, clean, dry, hoppy beer. And if we're thinking about the progression of IPA, rough IPA style categories, this is almost a reaction to what is now being called New England style IPA, which, not always, but definitely can have a lot of sweetness in it, not heavier body, but bigger body, more mouthfeel. This is super crisp, dry.
So it drinks light, but it packs a punch, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is, let's see what the ABV is. This is 8%, but I don't know that I would have guessed that this is 8% beer.
It's got this really nice lime vanilla thing going on to it as well, like a little bit of like a tropical pina colada type thing going on in the background.
And where does, on the shelf from before dinner to dinner, after dinner, where does this beer sit at?
I would put it within the first third. Right now, I think it's sitting somewhere near the middle, right?
I actually don't think this is out yet, so I'm going to write that down. And
I would drop it in as a first course beer.
Yeah, brewed IPAs. I got the question actually just this afternoon from somebody saying, like, you know, like, where do you put brewed IPAs with food? And I've been struggling in the back of my mind. I haven't come up with a good answer to that email yet. But yeah. Have you guys thought about that as well?
I would think. I mean, with this, I think definitely could handle some acidity. I think, you know, as a late summer thing, this is delicious with tomatoes.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
I think that could work really nicely. Whereas, you know, any of the bigger New England style IPAs are just sugar bombs, and it just
It rolls over everything else that's on the plate.
Destroys everything in its way.
Yeah, it's you mentioned Social Kitchen. They're crushing it these days. They're leading the charge. And there's breweries like Verboten out in Colorado, which are also doing some really cool things with them. And I think we're going to see more and more of these, Jim. It's kind of cool.
No, it's news to me. I mean, you guys at Beer Table, I don't know how people can subscribe, but you actually have a great newsletter. And this is
just
the
on
second,
our website.
Second show we did based on you guys. We did a barrel aged beer show earlier this year, and was inspired by your newsletter. And now this is you guys talking about the Brewed IPA. Who writes your newsletter?
Everyone. Megan sort of leads the charge on organizing everything, and then everyone participates.
Hey, Megan, welcome to the show. Welcome back.
Hey,
Megan Saxel, we just came in, one of your managers.
How's it going?
Yeah, and I was just saying how great your newsletter is, and thanks. People, it's nice to see that you guys put the time into, you know, communicating, you know, what's going on in the beer scene. So I really like that newsletter.
I should correct myself. The email newsletter is all Megan now. Our printed newsletter is everyone.
Yeah,
it's
but
a very different thing.
It's great, Megan. I just want to say thank you, because like I said, this is the second show we've done based on your newsletter.
Thanks so
much. Last one was barrel-aged beers, and now it's Brewed IPA today.
Thank you.
But we're talking with John. He just wrote this great book, Think Beer, Drink Beer, and we're talking about, you know, what are we drinking? We defined a little bit. Going back to, you know, we drink an independent label, craft beer, small batch, and I think what you guys are doing really showcases where beer's at. I mean, talk about how you guys sell beer. You know, tell us what some of the philosophy of the shop, because you seem like you've really had a big influence on it.
Well, when I came in, I mean, I just kind of tried to carry on what Justin and Trisha had already set up, which is a place to celebrate beer and to make sure it's included on the table. I mean, it's in the name, Beer Table, and that's really what we try to focus on. It's not a standalone beverage. It very much so belongs on the table and with food, much in the same way that a lot of people associate wine. I think arguably it pairs a lot better with a lot of different food than wine. It's not so pigeonholed into, you know, this goes with this and this goes with that. I think it, you know, as we're still seeing so many new things come out, like the Brewed IPA, there's so much stuff to play around with flavor and, you know, comparatively where we're at with beer now to where wine is, it's still so new. There's so much stuff to experiment with. And I think that we really try and celebrate that in the shop. And, you know, we don't try and say that we're the authority, we're learning right along with everybody. And so it's fun to kind of take that ride with our customers.
Yeah, I mean, how can you guys keep up? I mean, John, in your book, you said there's like 7,000 breweries in America now.
Yeah, we're getting up to that number now with another 1,000 or so in planning.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to keep up. I mean, you're lucky that you find the good stuff, right?
Yeah, we have a lot of good spies out there for us, so it certainly helps. But yeah, there's a lot to keep up with now.
That's great. What are some other breweries that I haven't heard of that you guys are selling? Because I feel like every time you're on the show, there's beer I've never had before.
I mean, something fun that just came in from Charleston, Edmund's Oast.
Yeah.
Really, really awesome stuff. We just had a tasting with them yesterday. We've got one going on as we speak at our World Trade Center location. So if you're listening live, head down there, try some Edmund's Oast. But yeah, they do some fun stuff.
I'm on my way through there on my way home. So now
there
it's,
go. There you go.
Sorry, April, I'll be home late.
But yeah, we've got this.
That's fine.
It's one of my favorite things that we've got in from them. It's an English mild. It's under 4%, done with some black tea that's roasted down in Charleston. And it's just a delicious, delicious beer. And you don't see that many American breweries making milds right now.
Not enough.
No. One of the breweries, actually, that I'm really excited about these days is called Bond Place. And they're out in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And they're doing milds as well. Sam Asato, who used to be a bartender up at Pony Bar back in the day, one of the great advocates of beer. We've written about him at Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine a little bit. We've had him on the podcasts, and he's doing a lot of milds. One, I think, at GABF last year, Great American Beer Festival last year, or World Beer Cup, one of those where they hand out medals. But yeah, he's doing some milds as well. It's nice to see this style come back. It's so nice.
One of my favorites, for sure.
I think the whole brown ale family, you know, people are... There's a lot more potential with it, but I don't know if people are... Are people drinking brown? I mean...
No.
No.
I just like to add that, like, I love that these guys get excited about this stuff and about old things, and that it's not all about the new breweries and the new beers coming out. We try to represent that, but a big thing that they do a really good job with is also trying to keep the old classics and keep older styles and, like, true diversity on the shelf, so it's not all just big, hazy IPAs.
Yeah.
I mean, I think... In the last, you know, year, 2 years, we've seen somewhat of a return the popularity amongst craft beer enthusiasts, lagers. I think so many more breweries are doing really, really quality versions of Pilsners and Helles Lagers and other styles too. But I feel like maybe brown things are going to be the next little micro trend in beer.
We can dream.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
In a perfect world, that'd be nice.
Cool. We're off to a great start, guys. Hey, Matt, the new engineer is here. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We've got the crew from Beer Table, one of the finest specialty beer shops in New York City, and John Hall, the author of Think Beer, Drink Beer. So we were actually just tasting a mild ale from Edmunds Oast in Charleston, which is new to me, but the style is not. You know, mild is another one of these dark, you know, lighter bodied, you know, brown colored beers. And it brings us to one of the chapters in John's book. You talk about the beer ingredients. And I really like this. There's some really good lines in your book. From America the Beautiful, that line, amber waves of grain. And John's talking about grains and malts, you know, which give color to beer. His line is, that pint of pale ale is downright patriotic.
Yeah. You know, and it's so interesting, right? As kids, we stand up and we sing America the Beautiful. And when we become adults and we actually, I was thinking about, because, you know, I was at one of my niece's plays or something, and they sang America the Beautiful, and I realized that these kids are singing about amber waves of grain, and while, yes, it probably is feed or bread or anything else like that, it's also beer, and that as kids we're not necessarily recognizing that, and as adults we're not necessarily, you know, thinking about that. And in the larger context as well, when people talk about beers these days, I think the first thing that they zero in on, the first thing is the hop content and the aroma and the flavor that comes from hops. But really, when we look at a beer, 9 times out of 10, it's the grain bill that we're looking at and seeing first and making our first opinions on. But then that's almost totally sideswiped in favor of hops. And so I try to spend a little bit of time in the book talking about the ingredients and the way that we should actually think about them and really appreciate them as well. And malt is certainly paramount. And I think in the next couple of years, we'll start to see if the malt growers can get out there and the brewers can certainly start talking about it. People will start saying like, oh, do you have XYZ malt in this? In the same way that we talk about Citra, a Mosaic and all of that. I think people will really start, I hope at least, to start to talk about their grain bill in specific terms as opposed to, oh yeah, it's really bready. It's got that cracker note to it. Like these generic terms that don't necessarily add all that much to it.
I mean, I know maybe 6 to 8 years ago, people were just starting to talk about local malt and, you know, there are a whole bunch of malt facilities in New York State when there weren't, you know, even 6 years ago. I don't know if that comes up, if any of the brewers are including, you know, descriptions of their malt or if anyone's doing like North Carolina local malt. I don't know if that's come up in any of the beers you guys are sampling or selling.
I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that when we're being sold a beer or when a distributor is bringing something in that they're saying, you're going to really want to try this. It's full of Maris Otter. But, you know, I wish that's what they were saying. But yeah. I think kind of what you're mentioning and, what we're seeing a little bit more of, especially with some of the smaller local breweries or the, you know, quote unquote farm breweries around, you know, there's been some legislation passed that's really trying to support that industry a little bit more in the state, which is exciting. And, you know, as you said, there's more maltsters that are coming up and coming online in the, you know, in our area. So I assume that's happening elsewhere. As far as my knowledge goes on that topic, it's a little bit more closer to home. So I don't know what's happening elsewhere, but, you know, off the top of my head, I can think of at least three maltsters that are within a, you know, a drivable distance, which is, for me, that's really exciting to see. You know, if there's enough agriculture going on to support someone who is then working on the grain, and there's three of them doing that, that's pretty exciting. So I just hope that that continues to grow. And I think it will.
Yeah, and I think maybe not something that customers are asking for yet, but we definitely have a few breweries that proudly put on their beer labels, you know, this was made with, I think, you know, Barry out of Ash will talk, will tell you if the grains they're using were grown and malted in North Carolina. Blackberry Farms at Tennessee will tell you this was made with floor malted, you know, whatever, Pilsner malt. And I'm sure Jack's Abbey also talks about using floor malted, you know, floor malted malt. And yeah. I think the breweries are talking about it, and I think consumers are going to catch on. Yeah, and my hope is that it becomes something everyone's looking out for.
You know, and Justin, your background was, you know, work for specialty importer Bee United, which meant you probably spent some time in Franconia. Did you ever go there and check out Schlenkerla?
Yeah, I've been a few times. Megan's been as well.
You know, back in the early days, were those traditional German breweries? Were they talking about, you know, using local malts or local ingredients?
I think it just naturally was. Not something to talk about necessarily.
But it was assumed that they were using German.
Absolutely. It was certainly a part of the conversation. I mean, part of the beer purity law, the purpose, you know, undertones of that were to make sure that brewers were using certain grains to make sure that there was plenty of other grains left over for bread makers, you know, and bakeries and things of that sort. So I think that it's been part of the conversation, not necessarily from like a taste perspective, more from a use perspective, but, you know, they've been talking about it for, I think, hundreds of years. And
I think one of the issues with the Soviet Union was that in Eastern Europe, they didn't really have enough. They weren't a bread basket, and I think they ended up having to use like beets and other things to make alcohol. I think that's one reason they didn't really have a beer industry, craft beer industry for a while. But John, and you, going back to your book, you know, back to grains. Let's be malt advocates. You know, I think this is what we're on to this segment. There are some larger craft breweries or independent breweries that are growing
just
their own
breweries.
Yeah. Growing their own grain too, aren't they?
Bell's is certainly. They have a bunch of acreage in Michigan, and they know where all their stuff is coming from. They're the first ones who come to mind, but there are certainly others as well. And you just have out in San Francisco right now, everybody's really excited about Admiral Maltings, which just went up, I want to say in Alameda, California, so just on the other side of the bay in San Francisco. And all the breweries out there are really excited about this floor malting. They can know where their malt is coming from now, and they're using it. In fact, I was just talking to Kim, the brewer at Social Kitchen, this afternoon. You know, he's the guy who invented the Brewed IPA, and they've actually changed one of their recipes. It used to be called, I guess, Mr. Kitt's Pale Ale, and now they're calling it Admiral Kitt's because they're using all Admiral malting, and they got rid of their Maris Otter, and they're using their own as well. So, you know, brewers are really excited about working with specialty malts and finding specialty malts. And, you know, if you're somebody like Bell's who can afford acreage and can afford your own fields, you know, I think it adds a little bit more depth. It adds a little bit more of that je ne sais quoi to the beer when you can, you know, point to something and say, I know where everything in that beer came from and not just from a catalog.
And that Bell is John Mallett.
Yeah.
Didn't he write the book on malt?
He wrote the book on malt, and I'm happy to say that He proofed my little bit in the book about that. I wouldn't have sent it out into the world without a blessing from Mallet, because the worst thing that would happen is getting the call like 2 weeks after it published, and he goes, yeah, you know, this is not accurate. So I called all of the experts in the various fields and asked them to read those chapters.
So who are some of the experts that you consulted with?
Stan Hieronymus when it came to hops, and Steve Parks when it came to yeast. And, a whole bunch of people read the book, I'm happy to say, in advance, and offered some really great feedback. Randy Mosher went through the entire manuscript with a fine-tooth comb, and I'll tell you what, one of the most humbling things in my life was getting a 5-page correction email, like single type from Randy Mosher, basically being like, do you know anything about beer or this industry? But I think it made the final product that much better. So I'm forever indebted to all of those fine folks, but especially Mr. Mosher.
What feedback have you gotten? You know, you're trying to define what beer is, and you just want to call it beer. You know, you're not so keen on the independent label. You're not so keen on the craft
it's
label.
It's kind of a silly label. Like I keep calling it like the National Ketchup Association. it goes two ways. There's some folks who say that I should be a bigger booster and a bigger supporter of craft or of independent. And I have to remind those folks that I'm not in the beer industry, but I cover the beer industry. And as an independent critic and as an independent journalist who covers this, I have to speak to all sides. And so, you know, even going back to my days at All About Beer, we would cover Anheuser-Busch and we would cover Miller Brewing Company because that was our job to do it. Like, we're not, you know, I don't see my job as a booster. I see my job as telling, you know, curious readers and listeners what's happening in the world, like, as we know it at that moment. You know, and then there's some really thoughtful people in the industry who are industry leaders who might have to toe the company line of banging this independence drum. But when I see them, they'll say privately, you know, yeah, I don't disagree with you. You know, I'm not going to say that out loud, but, you know, I don't disagree with you. And so, you know, I think that there's a lot of conversations happening on a lot of levels among a lot of people, and that I try to encourage drinkers, at least in this book, and in the same way that I think that all of us who interact with the public on a daily basis, encourage people to really think for themselves, to not just follow the company line, to not just believe that craft beer is better than all other beer, but to follow what it is that you like, and to not be afraid sometimes to just order a bud when you're out at a bar, or to just try something again, because, you know, I think it broadens our perspectives.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from a different angle. It's why I got in the industry in the first place. It started with wine, and I feel the same with beers. I want to go to specialty retailers like Beer Table, where I know that they're pre-selecting for me.
Yeah.
And I also like to work with, you know, select distributors. Let's talk about how you guys got Edmund Oast. So I know them. They were a brew pub in Charleston, and I was there last year. Yeah. We did a show with them in Charleston. When do they open a brewery, and how? What do they go through to sell in New York? Are they actually distributing here in New York, or this is like a one-time thing?
Yeah, they're here. As far as I know, their distribution range is very limited. New York is one of the few places outside of their home base where they're available. Which I think speaks volumes about how the New York beer industry has kind of grown in the last few years, that this would be the next place they wanted to jump to. We've loved having it. I think it really brings kind of a fresh new perspective on some things that maybe we've kind of forgotten about.
You just get closer.
Sorry. I mean, you know, what we've got here right now is the Lord Proprietor's Mild. And just about everything that they've brought in has been kind of like, I don't want to call it a forgotten style, but something that's just not like sexy and doesn't get a bunch of shelf time. So like one of the best things that we've gotten from them is this like really lovely blonde ale, you know, which is a style that forever ago would have been like mind changing to me. But I couldn't tell you the last time I had a blonde ale, let alone the last time I had a blonde ale, and was like, oh my God, this is amazing, you know? And so for me, it's been really fun. I would argue that almost all of their beers are meant to be had with food, which makes sense given their background. I mean, this was one that we were just so stoked to see come in, and you know, we've tried to carry as much as possible from them and support them as much as possible, as evidenced by having them in for tastings yesterday and today. So it's been fun. As to your original question, I can't tell you exactly when they opened the brewery part, but I know it's new.
Yeah, it's been in the last 2 years or so. We just did a profile of them on the in the magazine, and yeah, it's been relatively new. But they have the bottle shop, and they have the restaurant brew pub, and now they have their production brewery as well. And it's a hell of an operation that they have going on there.
It's fun to go down at Charleston in the spring for the wine and food festival. Heritage Radio Network goes down every year, so I was lucky to go there last year. And I sat at the bar at the Edmunds Oast, the pub. And actually, a guy working there used to go to my old place, Jimmy's Number 43. So nice. It's a little bit of a beer community. So I'm going to take another short break, Matt. We're going to be back in a few minutes and listen to these messages. And we'll be back on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're happy to be back. We took the summer off, and we're here with some of my favorite specialty beer retailers, the Beer Table Crew, Megan, Justin, and Noah. Great spot in Grand Central and at the World Trade Center, places to get beer on the go. But they really put so much care into selecting. I feel like it's really important that this world, where there's so many breweries now, I want someone pre-selecting for me. You know, I want a distributor that's I know, or importer. And now, in particular, you know, your bar or store, really, you need to trust them. Same way you do in a good wine shop. You know, and I feel like we're elevating beer to the level of wine. We also need establishments that are treating it that way. And that's what you're doing, right, Megan?
Certainly trying to. Yeah.
Well, John, you know, we're going to talk more about you as a journalist. You know, you're all about Beer Editor, and your book's out now, Think Beer, Drink Beer. But tell us about the current magazine that you work for.
It's called Craft Beer and Brewing. It's been around for, gosh, about half a decade now. And, you know, we cover the craft beer scene in America, but also the intersection of home brewing as well. So a lot of practical how-to advice, really getting into the processes and the nitty-gritty for the really active consumer of home brewing, who also still drinks a lot of commercial beer as well. So it's a fun intersection for me, because I get to really dive into ingredients and processes, which is not something that I did too much of in the past, but that's what my days are filled with now. And I get to talk to brewers about everything from, you know, brewing with maple syrup and salt to, you know, brewer's licorice and dandelion root and all these other fun things that are out there that add some really fun flavor to beers. And I got to tell you what, I'm going to be calling Edmunds Oast and asking them about tea, because that mild that we've been drinking is just burrowed itself into my brain at this point. And I'm not going to stop thinking about that anytime soon. So, yeah, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine, you can check it out at beerandbrewing.com.
Noah's cool, man. You got some great people working with you, Justin, at Beer Table, because he's kind of nodding along, and I'm waiting for some spout of genius from this guy, because everything he says is great.
I was going to say, I mean, one of the things that I love is to see our customers come in and start to be more interested in process and into where their product is coming from, which is what we're talking about. You know, we want people to be excited about malt and not just hops. And I think it's cool that we still have publications out there that are really putting that information out there for, you know, interested customers to consume.
Yeah. I, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the ingredients chapter as well, of just knowing where things come from. Like, it's sort of amazing when you say to even like hardened beer geeks, or the untapped warriors, or the folks who, you know, go on some of these message forums and scream and shout about beer all day long. It's like, hey, where do hops come from? the farm? Like, and they don't really know. And I think one of the big things that as all consumers, like, we need to start thinking about is water and clean water and making sure that we have the availability to it. You know, I mean, Flint, Michigan taught us that, you know, even our municipal water isn't guaranteed to be fresh. And without fresh, clean water, certainly we're all going to be without beer down the line. So I think that, you know, beer fans can take up arms in some ways and be demanding of better practices environmentally, because if they want to keep drinking better beer.
Definitely. I mean, I appreciate all the push to consume local product, be it beer or food. And, you know, I think New York State's making a lot of great beer. But one of my favorite things about the rise in New York State, especially farm breweries that are required to use a certain percentage of New York State grown ingredients in their beer, is that if I can say to somebody, hey, this beer uses hops and malt that are from New York State, like, the consumer thinks about that and they're like, oh, like, this was malted down the road from where I live and these hops are grown close to where I live. And that just gets them thinking about the process more and diving deeper into it. And it makes it more relatable for them. And I think it just, you know, it's it makes the conversation better.
Yeah, a personal connection with beer is so important. It goes beyond the Instagram shot and the untapped check-in. Like, I think if you can really recognize, like, where your money is going and what your money is supporting every time you plunk down $10 for a pint, or, you know, $20 for a six pack, or, like, whatever it is these days. Yeah, I don't buy beer, so I have no idea. It's
one of those houses I should come visit.
Yeah, man. No, it's one of the perks that I have as a journalist. I get a lot of stuff sent for samples and everything. But you know, but I think that if people know where their money is going, it forges a deeper connection with what's in their glass.
And Megan, in terms of selling, you know, we talked about how you guys set up the store from before dinner, after dinner styles of beer. How do you sell beer? Are people coming in asking for the newest, coolest thing? Are you guys saying, oh, we just tried this, it's really great? I mean, is there a typical customer, you know, customer interaction?
I would say that there's two answers to that. We're in a really unique location. We're in Grand Central, as we've established, and World Trade to a certain extent, where people are, they're on a timeline, right? And they've got 3 minutes to talk to you, to get the beer, and to get out of the store, max. In that case, you know, we really just try and nail down exactly what beers we want to sell for that day for certain scenarios and put it into your hand. And, you know, much like you're talking about, it's amazing that our customers at this point trust us to have curated a selection and to know their tastes. You know, so many of our customers are repeat customers, which is amazing, that they know that we're going to put the best beer for what they like to drink into their hands. I would say the other scenario we have, and it's like my favorite kind of customer, who typically comes in either on the weekend or in the afternoons and has got a little bit of time to kill, and they just want to pick your brain, you know, and have a conversation about beer and learn about what you're into, and then we in turn can learn about what they're into and come to a decision on what is going to be the perfect beer for them for this day, for what they're doing later, you know. And I was just in the store on, you know, when would that have been? Yesterday? And a guy came in and was kind of quiet and, you know, minding his own business, and just happened to say, like, hey, have you heard of this brewery that just opened in Ohio? I think it's like a BrewDog thing or something like that. I was like, well, you know, luck would have it, I was there visiting family a couple weeks ago. Let me tell you all about it. This was really cool and blah, 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 blah. And those are the kind of interactions that I love to have, right? Because it's for, you know, for me, it's exciting just to talk about things that I'm excited about and things that I'm really passionate about. And for them, it's amazing because it's putting a face to an experience. It's putting a face to someone who's been there, who's checked it out. And, you know, for me, that's 10 times better than a Yelp review. I'd rather talk to somebody who's been there and done it and whose opinion I trust than, you know, some anonymous person online who's just angry that, you know, that took 10 minutes to get their beer instead of 9, you know? So those are my favorite kind of interactions, is to really pick somebody's brain and just listen to what they're saying and maybe give them 3 safe bets and something out of left field that I think they might like, but that they'd never reach for.
Noah, you're my new beer guru, man.
Thank you. I'm going to lead you into some weird places.
So on that note, she's talking about BrewDog. So, like, I like the beers we've had so far, and, you know, Brute IPA, I'm intrigued by. You know, I thought when you first said it, even though I'd read your newsletter, I thought you said brewed IPA. And I'm like, wow, they're actually using the word brewed in beer.
What would that be?
And I was like, maybe someone's, who's going to make a brewed IPA?
That's the new style. That's after the independence. One, yeah. Is your beer brewed or not? Yeah. It's,
I only drink things that are brewed.
You know, it's like cold brew coffee. Like
personally, I'm into the raw beer myself. It's, yeah. I just want the four main ingredients
just
served to me separately.
Yeah,
it's
the cold brewed beer, you know. Which I
don't
know
even joke. Somebody's going to do that for real. Like, that's been the big thing with April Fool's Day every year is like the brewers who are like, oh, we're doing a pork chop beer. Like, aren't we funny on April Fool's Day? And it's like, come on, fellas. Like, somebody's already done that. And if they're not, they're going to soon. So, like, yeah, it's raw beer is going to be a thing soon enough. Yeah.
I mean, the one thing that really intrigued, I mean, I think it's fun that there is a new take on the IPA. The one thing I'm really curious about, I suppose, in terms of IPA is, or in terms of brewed IPA is this going to be like the next New England, you know, quote unquote, New England style IPA? Is this going to be something that takes the kind of brewing community by storm and everybody's obsessed with it? Or is it going to be kind of a short-lived fad?
Black IPA, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Is this the next Cascadian?
Cascadian.
I'm sorry.
I still like
Black American IPA. Dark Ale? I'm sorry, yeah.
And I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's fun, especially in the lower ABV iterations. You know, it's easy to drink and tasty. I was kind of surprised at how quickly it spread around the country. I feel like with New England-style IPA, that was a several-year process before it really hit the West Coast and became a thing there. But this felt like a matter of months before it traversed the country, and we were seeing...
I mean, is there like a style section now for brute IPA?
It's not at GABF, yeah. But it probably will be soon enough.
It has.
Yeah, everybody's making it at this point. Everybody's really excited. And the cool thing about it, as I've written in the magazine, we did one of the early articles on this, which I was thankful for, is that there's no set process for it yet. So when Kim at Social Kitchen started using this enzyme, he was adding it during the fermenter, during fermentation, but they also reuse their yeast, and he didn't want this enzyme contaminating his yeast. So now he's putting it into the fermenter, now he's putting it into his mash as he's starting... the brew process so that it's not necessarily getting down to zero Plato like he had hoped. But everybody's trying different things with it now. And now that this sort of door has been unlocked, all brewers are just rushing to be like, all right, well, how can I put my own twist on this as well? And we're already seeing the fruited brute IPA.
I think we've got one of those here today.
Yeah, oh, do it? Okay. Yeah, Cane Brewing down in Jersey, they just did a peach and something puree brewed IPA for their 7th anniversary. And that, to me, speaks volumes that a brewery putting out an anniversary beer, one of these seminal beers, is doing something that is on a style that is less than a year old in the known world right now. I think I don't know if it's going to go the way of black IPA or white IPA or the others, but I think for right now, this is an exciting time to be trying this style.
And maybe because it's not dark, people, it'll catch yeah. on. There's still an issue of dark versus light. What's this next beer that we're drinking?
Oh, I was down at Treadwell Park in near the World Trade Center before I came over here, and I picked up an old school West Coast IPA because I thought I'd be novel and different. And this is just Knee Deep's.
I'm not actually familiar with that style. Could you tell me about it?
So it's clear. It's bitter on the finish. It has pine and a little bit of dankness to it as well. I'd refer you to 2005.
She was not born then.
Yeah, so this is just Knee Deep.
This is great.
Their West Coast IPA. And God, when I saw it on tap, I got really excited because I don't drink a lot of the milkshake stuff. Like I think it can be fun. But when I can see a crystal clear West Coast IPA that is unadorned and done the way that our grandparents demanded it, damn it, I'm just a sucker for it. So that's why I brought a crowler of it. And
yeah. Where'd you get it on draft?
Treadwell Park.
Oh, great. Down in, Ann Becerra. Ann likes beer.
Yeah, Ann does like beer. So they have a crowler station. As you can leave, you can get any beer that you want for a lot of money. I briefly considered bringing a barrel-aged Scotch ale. Because that was actually like really intriguing to me, and then they're like, "Yeah, the crowler price is $45," and I was like, "Oh, I don't like Jimmy that much." so I got the more affordable West Coast IPA, and I'm digging it. But what's the fruited Brut IPA that you guys brought?
We have one from Fair State, who are out of Minnesota.
Yeah, those guys are great. They make a fantastic Pilsner, by the way.
Yeah, and they, I mean, I guess they've been in the New York market for maybe almost a year now.
Yeah,
But yeah, they do great stuff, and we have a non-fruited and a fruited Brut from them.
Ooh.
I feel like you guys are really lucky because you're really more of a bottle shop. And I think about when you have a pub or a restaurant, you've only got a certain number of draft lines. And I remember a few years ago, I felt that I couldn't keep up with all the new breweries because I couldn't carry that many different beers, you know. But you guys, how many do you have usually in the store, like 400 different beers?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, at one time, we've got room on the shelves for like just around 100 different unique beers. And we have 6 lines at both locations. But I think kind of the blessing that we didn't necessarily plan on is that both stores are very tiny and we don't have a ton of room for back storage. So as soon as something runs out, we need something to take its place. And so we're constantly just churning through inventory. And, you know, it means getting probably more deliveries than most people would like for a store of that size. But it's really been super helpful for us in that we just don't have a ton of stuff sitting around. And so we can kind of keep up, you know, it more or less. I often have the same sentiment that you have. I'm just like, oh my gosh, everything is passing me by that we need. And, you know, we just don't have space for this. But there will always be another, you know, release next week, so it's fine.
But you're lucky, so your customers really trust you now. They know that they're going to get a lot of good choices. They probably get to try more things in most other places. I mean, I can't think of another place where, I mean, every beer you've let me taste today, I've never tried. So
yeah,
you guys are awesome.
It's an embarrassment of riches.
And John, just a shout out to your professionalism. We did a show a couple summers ago at WNYC together.
Yeah.
And John comes on, of course, with a blazer and a bow tie.
That's right.
And I said, John, you look great. And he looks at me and he says, Jimmy, you got to dress for the job you want. And I was like, uh-oh.
I'm sorry I didn't get dressed up for the show today. I'm but it's schwamp. Radio, so, you know, it's...
Yeah, you got a bow tie on. You always have a bow tie.
There it is.
And I think you mentioned you talk about handcrafted. Do you actually get handcrafted bow ties from Vermont, don't
it's
you?
It's not handcrafted. They're hand-sewn. But, like, yeah, there's a small company in Vermont that's actually in Middlebury that's not far. They're near Long Trail and the Cabot Creamery and all. It's you know, it's the Bowtie District. And but, you know, but I make the point in the book that, you know, if you want to spend your money the right way and you know where your dollars are going, it goes back to what you were saying about beer, you know, you can't necessarily do it with an iPhone. You can't necessarily do it with a car. You can't necessarily do it with a lot of other things in our life. But, you know, if there are things that you can do, if it's T-shirts or bow ties or anything else, it feels good when you spend money on things where you know that the money is going and supporting, you know, good people. Same thing like going to a good bar and spending your money there, or a bottle shop going there as opposed to going to a chain or going to something like that, you know?
And that's a theme that I can agree on, is supporting local. And we'll have more talk about that on the rest of the shows this year. We got a lot coming up every Tuesday at 5. We're back, Beer Sessions Radio. And you guys, let's just go through. We got to close out, but just again, say your names and your affiliations.
Justin Phillips from Beer Table.
Rotary Club.
Megan Sachs will be Beer Table.
Noah Levin, Beer Table.
John Hall from Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine, the new book, Drink Beer, Think Beer, Getting to the Bottom of Every Pint, and the podcast, Steal This Beer.
All right. Well, thanks for coming out, guys. Big shout out to new engineer Matt Patterson. We got a new intern, Dylan, and our producer, Justin Kennedy. Thanks for putting together the show. I'm Jimmy Carboni. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Welcome back, Woo! Jim.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.